Let's get started. My name is Jerry Cotton. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion here at UCLA. I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to act as your moderator for this really extraordinarily interesting panel, Anti-Semitism, Past and Present, Reflections in the Aftermath of Pittsburgh. I want to thank, obviously, the conveners, including the Luskin Center for History and Policy, the UCLA Levy Center for Jewish Studies, and all the other people who contributed to actually put this panel together at such an important moment, arguably in American history, as we think about the perennial problem of what has long been called the longest hatred. My job is in some ways simple. I'm going to set out a few concepts and some reflections, but then actually just introduce our extraordinary speakers. Someone else will keep time, and then I'll try to pick a fight amongst them in the Q&A. Here's the two things that I want to just share with you as an administrator. I've been a faculty member at the law school for about 20 years, and then kind of injected myself somewhat surprisingly, into senior administration, dealing with equity, diversity, and inclusion before the summer bloodshed that led to Black Lives Matter, just before, again, the Me Too movement, just before the unexpected results of a presidential election that really reconfigured how these questions of equity, diversity, and inclusion, belonging, understanding the pain of others, even as we might ourselves be the source of hatred of others, as those questions were being contested. And in that experience, and it's been quite a ride, I learned a couple things, and there's just two things I want to share that I think might be relevant for this conversation. Number one, the university matters. The university really matters. A public university really, really matters. Because hate and conflict is swirling all around us. Of course, it's hate globally and nationally will have local manifestations. It would be extraordinary if there were no reverberations here. And the local echoes have affected all of us. But as those conflicts echo here, I want to insist that they reverberate slightly differently within the halls of a university. I think we have an obligation, and I'm not talking about just a social obligation towards social justice. I think we have an obligation to use our minds. I think we have an ethical obligation to engage our critical faculties, to learn as hard as we can, to ask the hardest questions, to be able and mature enough intellectually, put aside emotionally and otherwise, be intellectually mature enough to engage in forms of self-critique, in part because I'm not sure that other institutions are doing this in America. When I think about other institutions writ large, our elected officials, private sector, I see failure in a lot of different places. And if the university is to be something different, it must model a certain form of engagement, where we have an ethical obligation to use our minds, right, to ask the hardest questions, both on facts and values, to at least understand why we disagree when we disagree. And that's why I'm so excited to actually hear the views of our extraordinary panelists. The second thing that I want to emphasize, besides the fact that the university does matter, is that what the university does best, and what the smartest folks in the university do best, is that we make the invisible visible. I mean that in a cryptic way, but I want to suggest that the disciplines that we study, whether it be the sciences, hard sciences, natural sciences, social sciences, even history in different kinds of ways, what these disciplines do is they make the invisible visible. Again, sometimes it's through scientific technologies. I do a lot of work on implicit bias, which means that what I'm trying to do is try to figure out whether you got junk in your head, baggage, that sounds like prejudice, that sounds like stereotypes, that sounds like negative attitudes, that you don't even know that you have, because you would never admit them to yourselves, because they all seem wrong. But nevertheless, because your brain is like a sponge, because you are what you see in some sense, you end up having associations with certain groups of people that are positive or negative, that you don't even know that you have, that you would resent or reject if you knew you had them, but nevertheless influence your behavior. And that's a certain kind of technology, to see prejudice, even if people claim they don't have it, to see stereotypes, even when they deny ever using them, about men versus women, about whites versus blacks, about Jews versus Gentiles, about Muslims versus people of other faiths. sometimes we make the invisible visible by interrogating the past, because we're so presentist in our minds, and I have a terrible mind for history, I can't remember a damn thing. But the truth is, one of the things that a social science or a humanities or an interpretive practice like history does, it allows us to see things at an epic scale. If we're just focused on this, literally, like if we're just focused on this, we see again a scrolling, a never-ending kind of tweet fest of the present, and we don't get to see the bigger structures, the vectors of forces that actually collide upon us and influence us in different kinds of ways, right? So we have to see the past. We have to see larger structures. We have to see structures that are hard to see, because all that we are looking at in any given moment is the small cutout in front of us, especially when we become agitated or threatened. And that's one of the beautiful things of a different kind of discipline or technology that is, in my view, history. So our goal is to see what we could not see before. Our goal is to see better and beyond what most people see and talk about. That's the challenge of the university. Whether we can pull it off is always an open question. And we have to answer that question every single day, and not self-congratulating way, just pat ourselves for being smarter or better in all kinds of ways. I think it's a challenge, not so much a given. With all that, I've spoken too long. All that I want to do is to get really excited about the extraordinary people that we have in front of you. The people will be speaking in this order, and I will give a one-sentence intro only. If they're really interesting, then you should just Google them. First up will be David Myers, who is the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Chair of Jewish History and the Director of the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. For people who know David and respect his intellectual integrity, his service to so many different communities, we're all delighted that he's back. Number two, after David, to his right, at the far end, will be Brenda Stevenson, who is the Nicole Family Endowed Chair and Professor of the Department of History and African American Studies, also a superstar, and it will be a treat to hear her insights and comparisons with different groups. Third on the list will be Aziza Hassan in the center, who is the Executive Director of an organization called New Ground, a Muslim-Jewish partnership for change. And again, as I see fewer and fewer examples of people willing to, bridge differences for positive change, I'm always excited to meet new people who do that kind of work with fervor and intelligence. And finally, but not least, Josh Kuhn, who is the director of the School of Communication. He's got multiple titles: professor of communication and journalism, chair in cross-cultural communications at the other school in town.
Occidental?
Different colors, red and yellow. Or gold. In any event, he's fancy and smart. 2016 MacArthur Fellow, amongst other things. And the goal is each person will just take 10 minutes or less, to actually state their insights and ideas. Someone will harangue them if they go on too long, and then we're going to have a really interesting conversation. And again, part of what we need to do is model the kind of intellectual maturity, the kindness, the sincerity, but the rigor that we want to see in the rest of the world. And if we can't do that even in just this moment, then we also fail. And that's a challenge for all of us. With that, David Myers. Give him a round.
Thank you, Jerry, both for the very kind introduction, for the framing of today's event, and really for your heroic service in your always gratifying job as Vice Chancellor. It's really a great pleasure to have you. I also want to thank the co-sponsors, whom Jerry mentioned, but they deserve additional praise: the Center for Jewish Studies, the Center for the Study of Religion, the History Department. I have the privilege of directing the Luskin Center for History and Policy, which is the main sponsor for today's event. The Luskin Center, for those of you who don't know, is committed to bringing historical perspective and depth to questions of contemporary relevance, and that's what brings us to, in fact, this session devoted to anti-Semitism. We felt an urgent need to do something to bring historical depth and perspective in the wake of the tragic shooting in Pittsburgh on October 27th at the Tree of Life Synagogue on Shabbat morning, Saturday morning. It's additionally tragic that shootings such as this are not that uncommon in the United States. But this instance is set apart by one important fact, and that is it was motivated by really a millennial-old hatred of the Jews, a hatred that in many respects defies rational explanation. And I would say what is perhaps even more rationale-defying is the fact that if we look at 21st century America, we can see Jews as if an integrated element in American society in virtually every domain of existence. And so there's something confounding and vexing and mystifying about the persistence of this age-old hatred in light of the successful integration of Jews into American society. And so what I'd like to do is to propose five factors or sources of explanation about anti-Semitism, drawn from my own vocation as an historian, as well as my commitment to trying to understand the relevance of the lessons of the past for the present. I should add, for any undergraduates or graduate students in the room, I'm going to be offering a quarter-long course on anti-Semitism in the spring quarter, so we'll have an opportunity to explore the phenomenon at great length then. So the first point I'd like to make about anti-Semitism is its antiquity. The term itself, anti-Semitism, is a new one, relatively speaking. It was given to us, as it were, by a German journalist by the name of Wilhelm Marr in the 1870s. In 1879, he formed a League of Anti-Semites. And by that, he sought to bring together like-minded Germans intent on removing Jews and their polluting effect from German civic life. But the concept, the phenomenon of what another contemporary of Wilhelm Marr from a very different perspective called Judeophobia, the phenomenon is a very old one. It extends back thousands of years. It's been called, as Jerry mentioned, the longest hatred by the historian Robert Wistrich. And for the sake of brevity, I would distinguish or divide the phenomenon into two phases, the pre-modern phase and the modern phase. So the pre-modern phase is a phase very much animated by theological hostility. If we extend back 2,000 years to the smoldering husks of the destroyed temple in Jerusalem in the year 70, if we look through the mist, we can see the emergence of a very intense theological rivalry between rabbinic Judaism and early Christianity that consolidated and crystallized over the course of several centuries into a very intense animus or hostility. The mission of differentiating itself, Christianity's task of differentiating itself from Judaism, led to a series of rather pejorative and demeaning projections onto Judaism that really retained their force for centuries. Perhaps the foundation of those demeaning and pejorative projections and sources of hostility was the claim that Jews were responsible for the most heinous crime imaginable, the crime of the death of the Christian God, deicide. That is really the anchor of the theological hostility towards the Jews that we can identify in this pre-modern period. It's important to add that the theological competition, especially amongst the monotheistic creeds, was unique, it was intense, but not unique to that between Judaism and Christianity. Islam was also a competitor in this competition, as it were, for exclusive truth. And indeed, we know that Islam adopted an attitude towards Jews and Christians as people of the book that granted them a subordinate but protected status. That was understood in different periods of time and different historical contexts in various ways. Sometimes that status, that subordinate protected status, was more subordinate than protected, and in some instances was more protected than subordinate. So it really varied according to historical circumstance. But the point of this first part of the first of 5 points I want to make is that theological animus was really the foundation of anti-Jewish expression in the pre-modern period. That stands in contrast to the phenomena that emerges in the 19th century that prompted Wilhelm Marr to give this phenomenon a new name, anti-Semitism. And that is hatred of Jews based on their perceived racial inferiority. This is in an era of scientific racialism that met together with a kind of very fervent chauvinistic nationalism to stigmatize groups deemed other in particular national societies, but which very often carried the veneer of a scientifically verifiable racial inferiority. So that was a characteristic feature of anti-Semitism in its modern face. And the great political thinker, German Jewish American Hannah Arendt, captured the particular potency of this form of modern anti-Semitism when she famously said in The Origins of Totalitarianism, from Judaism, that is to say the theologically based form, one could escape through conversion. From Jewishness, that more modern form, racially based, one could not escape. It was, in that sense, ineradicable. And that is an ironic segue to my second point about the phenomenon of anti-Semitism and its characteristic features, because one of the things that most strikes me about the staying power of anti-Semitism is its malleability. The fact that anti-Semitism can wear so many different forms over and over again. The rationale and the form change, the focus on the Jews remain. So what am I talking about? Well, Jews were perceived, I mentioned just a minute ago, as responsible for the crime of deicide. So as Christ killers, shortly thereafter, by which I mean about 1,000 years later, they were perceived in medieval Christendom as a poisoner of wells, as bearers of disease, as possessing actually physicalized satanic attributes. Somewhat later, they were understood to be usurious moneylenders. In Shakespeare's words, exactors of a pound of flesh. Then later, as we make our way into the early modern times, as racially impure, as we move into the 19th and 20th centuries, as arch-capitalists, or quite the opposite, revolutionary communists, and sometimes those two came out of the same mouth. These latter two qualities, in fact, arch-capitalist and revolutionary communist, merge in what is, and here I use the term somewhat ironically, the most successful piece of anti-Semitic propaganda or literature ever produced, namely the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, right? Produced in the early 20th century, and then reproduced in the hundreds of millions of copies over the course of the 20th and 21st century. At the center of this book is the claim that a cabal of Jews who mix the quality of being arch-capitalists and revolutionary communists are intent on global domination and exploitation of the world in that cause. So, malleability, very striking, powerful characteristic of anti-Semitism and a key to its staying power. The third point, the scapegoating quality of anti-Semitism. There are shifting rationales, there are shifting attributes to the Jews, and there are even shifting rationales to a certain extent, we might say, but the Jew remains, the focus on the Jew remains. Which reminds us of, I think, a very basic and unsettling fact, which is societies need to find a vulnerable target to stigmatize. Jews have served repeatedly as the classic other in many, especially Western societies, but not exclusively. They obviously are not the only source of stigmatization, but they are a recurrent target, including in our own times. Fourth point, the trend of anti-Semitism, the arc of anti-Semitism in our time. Since the Second World War, and certainly over the last quarter century, I think it's fair to say that anti-Semitism in America, which in many respects is the most successful site of Jewish existence in history, and certainly in the diaspora, anti-Semitism in this country has been on a path of historic decline. Now, having said that, it's important to note that the last 2 years have seen a significant uptick in reports of anti-Semitic incidents. Some of you may have read the audit of the Anti-Defamation League, the venerable organization committed to combating anti-Semitism, which showed a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2017. 2016 and 17 together, a 100% increase in the number of incidents reported. Similarly, the FBI reports a 37% increase from 2016 to 17. Again, this in a very important way, counters the trend that we've seen over the last quarter century and certainly since the Second World War. It's important to note that Jews are hardly alone as victims of hate crimes. According to the FBI, religiously based crimes in which they include anti-Semitism constitute 20% of the hate crimes that the FBI collects statistics on. 60% of the incidents that the FBI collects statistics on are racially based crimes in which Jews are not considered. So I have to say that in considering this uptick, and I know Lindsay's keeping time, and I was the one who said I only took 7 minutes rather than 10, so I'll try and wrap up very quickly, even though I have one more point to make. I find it hard to dissociate this uptick in anti-Semitic activity and expression from the broader political discourse of the United States, which is filled with vilification and demonization of one's opponents. I believe that Donald Trump's own words have had a significant impact on that environment. I don't know whether Donald Trump is an anti-Semite. I tend to think not, which is to say, I don't think he hates Jews more than others particularly. But I do think that his advisors and those around him have cultivated an outreach to the far right white nationalist camp, including through some dog whistling that really verges into dangerous territory. And Exhibit A, in this regard, is the frequent attack on so-called globalists, unquote, which is really shorthand for Jewish financiers who are alleged to be seeking control of the world. Now, these kinds of claims may seem, on the face of it, far-fetched, but I want to emphasize just 2 points here. One, they're drawn directly from the protocols of the Elders of Zion, directly from the claim of a Jewish cabal of financiers intent on world domination. And second, these claims about Jewish globalism are related to the chance of white supremacists, for example, in Charlottesville and elsewhere, that Jews will not replace us. Right? The Jews are intent on displacing, on co-opting, on taking over. Many of these claims are related to the Jewish financier, George Soros, and I have to just emphasize that these targets, the Jewish globalists and George Soros amongst them, were targets explicitly mentioned by Robert Bowers, the alleged Pittsburgh murderer. So, a final point. Contemporary varieties of anti-Semitism, here I'll be very brief. So, the charge of Jewish world domination fuels the white nationalist movement. This is important because, to my mind, they represent the most active anti-Semitic threat in this country. It's they who preach hatred against the Jews, it's they who call for and undertake violence against the Jews, and it's they who have found a niche in the current political culture. Now, I want to add a qualification to that point, and that is the claim of Jewish world control is not restricted to the right. It appears as well on the left, and it often takes the form of a Jewish lobby that dictates American or world policy on Israel. Remember this came up on this very campus several years ago, I think it was 2015, in the case of a student named Rachel Beda, who was applying for a position on the judicial board of student government, and was challenged because she was a Jew and assumed to have certain views on Israel. And I would just say that this is wrong and should be condemned. The automatic association between Jew and all things Israel is wrong. The ascription of responsibility to a single Jew for the actions of a government is wrong. We can talk about that later. I want to retain focus on what concerns me most about the current iteration of anti-Semitism in the wake of Pittsburgh, which is the lethal mix of white nationalism, violent rhetoric, and we have to add readily accessible guns. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Welcome. I speak tonight in peace and solidarity with my fellow panel members and the members of the community who are gathered in this room. Thank you for this opportunity to engage in this discourse. 1 month ago, a gunman killed 11 Jewish worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 3 days before, another gunman killed 2 black persons at the Kroger grocery store on the outskirts of Louisville, Kentucky, after trying unsuccessfully to enter a First Baptist church, which is a local black place of worship. Thankfully, the doors were locked. Unlike the AME church in Charleston that welcomed Dylan Roof into their prayer service 3 years ago, and as a result, suffered the loss of 9 of their members. 13 people dead, but where would these massacres have ended if these gunmen had not been forcibly stopped? These hate crimes, one of many that have witnessed racist, anti-Semites, and other violently targeting, and others violently targeting people of different colors and cultures from them, extend a bloody, devastating legacy forged over the generations in American history. So David did the ancient, I'm doing the more modern. Churches, synagogues, and mosques burned and bombed. Political, social, and cultural leaders targeted and killed. Families separated and destroyed. Workers turned into slaves. Cultures maligned. Land and businesses confiscated while their rightful owners were subject to genocidal acts. Men put in cages. Women denied motherhood. Women and men denied marital rights, and the crimes against humanity pile higher and higher. This is one legacy shared by many. And unfortunately, it is a legacy that was able to dig its roots deeply into American foundations because of its institutionalization in law and extra legal but accepted practices. Consider, for example, the shared marginalization and experiences of Jewish and black people in the United States at the end of the 19th and into the 20th centuries. At the end of the 19th century, African-American migrants fled the vicious repression of the racist segregated South, while Jewish immigrants arrived from violent, repressive Eastern Europe. Both groups searched for safety and protection for their families, greater freedoms, economic promise, and hope for a brighter future for their children. Hundreds of blacks lost their lives to violent extra-legal means, thousands more legal ones, but we were not the only ones to do so. Organizations like the Klan, and there were several more, and persons like the Robert Bowers and Gregory Bushes of today targeted anyone who was different, including Catholics, Jews, Asians, indigenous peoples, those from Mexico, Southern and Eastern Europeans, as well as those considered social deviants who were then divorced persons and alcoholics, for example. Imagine those were the people considered deviant at the time. African Americans, however, were their central focus. Blacks fled the South, but they could not escape the hate. In northern cities, they met Jewish immigrants with histories too of vilification, repression, and violence, long histories. Experiences that did not disappear when they arrived in America. These Jewish immigrants and black migrants both struggled mightily to make and take advantage of opportunities to achieve family and community stability, as well as individual success in their homes. Their welcomes, however, were a mixed bag. As the number of Jewish immigrants from Russia and Eastern and Central Europe climbed, the response of quote unquote mainstream America response hardened. The response of mainstream America hardened. Indeed, the arrival of Jewish immigrants at the turn of the 20th century coincided with one of the most vehement anti-immigration campaigns in the nation's history. The laws on immigration and naturalization that affected Jews, as well as those from Asia, Africa, and Southern Europe, mounted from the 1880s onward. Discriminatory immigration laws charged taxes for all non-resident persons arriving, excluded those from considered to have serious illnesses and with documented moral flaws, refused to admit known anarchists and political leftists, or the illiterate. These laws created immigrant quotas, reducing substantially the flow of Jews from Central Europe. organizations like the Immigrant Restriction League, founded by the elite men of Boston, but grew nationally to include branches in New York, San Francisco, and other cities, had as its principal goal to, quote, keep America for the Americans. Sound like something we hear today? Others, they argued, were an affront to decent, hardworking Christian white Americans. None deserved to be treated as citizens or reap the benefits of that citizenship. Russian Jewish immigrants in particular were demonized as political anarchists. Asian, that is Chinese and later Japanese, for example, were tainted with a perception of foreignness that signified peril of all types and disloyalty as well. Both were thought to be as much an affront to American democracy, to American greatness, as, quote, intellectually inferior blacks, end of quote. Indeed, some considered Jews to be akin to African Americans, darkening their skin in depictions of this very famous political cartoon, The Stranger at Our Door, and his unwanted baggage of anarchy, Sabbath desecration, poverty, superstition, intoxication, and disease. It is these dehumanizing characteristics that still play madly in the imaginations of those who hate and kill, not only Jews, but also others, all others. This is not news. We all know of the cooperative efforts in the past meant to eradicate hate, oppression, and exclusion that led to the creation, for example, of the NAACP, the Urban League, and joint civil rights marches, boycotts, sit-ins, and freedom rides. Perhaps fewer of us know that during the World War II era, black newspapers such as the Chicago Defender hired Jewish journalists and printed numerous stories that had helped to expose the Jewish Holocaust, linking it to the plight of black Americans at home. And that legacy of cooperation also continues. We must remain linked in our recognition of the hatred aimed at us and our efforts to eradicate it. Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So I have the joy and the pleasure of bringing together Muslims and Jews, and we've been doing this for a good 12 years now. I moved my life from Kansas, and I drove across in a nice little U-Haul with my siblings who helped me unpack my... Forgive me, I just came back from Kansas with a cold. We unpacked our U-Haul and decided to build something that was different, something that both built... Thank you. Both built on the successes of past efforts and figuring out where we could do something different so that we could build something stronger together. And so what Newground does is we bring Muslims and Jews together to transform community through the power of relationship. We do it by having intentional, hard, difficult conversations over and over again sometimes, but in a space that honors the different people in that space. And so I mention this specifically because one of the things that we're about to do actually tomorrow night, David is very well familiar with, is we have different programs. One in particular is for professionals, people who are willing to come together and sit together through the course of a 10-month stretch for about 3.5 hours every night. And tomorrow night we're going to be discussing anti-Semitism, where we invite people in and we ask the individuals who are sitting around the table, these different professionals who are everything from attorneys, engineers, journalists, heads of organizations, all sorts, all the way across the gamut, Muslims and Jews side by side, willing to have these conversations. And what's interesting is 12 years ago when we first started having this conversation about anti-Semitism, we would first ask the fellows, the individuals, the professionals, to share some stories about personal experiences with anti-Semitism. And not so many would have specific stories about anti-Semitism that they had experienced. These are individuals in their 30s and 20s, and now we've kind of lifted the age limit a little bit. But as we continued, and especially in the most recent past, things have started to shift. And I know that they especially shifted because I'm reminded that when I landed into Kansas City Airport this last, Wednesday, I started to feel it in my bones, and I remembered the shooting at the temple in Kansas City. It seems like one example after the other of these really incredibly heartbreaking instances where anti-Semitism is deadly and lethal and is not only a problem, but is something that we have to start to counteract together as a community. And I remember that specifically because Sarah Bassin, who is a rabbi at Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, I had spoken at her synagogue maybe the year before, and she grew up in that synagogue. And something different happened for me. It wasn't anti-Semitism that I read about in a book. It wasn't something that I knew in an important history lesson. It was a real person that I deeply cared about and her family that I deeply cared about. And as I think about the different people who have talked about these really difficult conversations and had to look at each other in the eye and say, I don't know if anti-Semitism is the same as it was, if it was as violent as it was in the past. But then more recently, I remember looking out at the vigil at the federal building. I know a number of you were there. And I remember seeing one face after the other of different people of different faiths coming together, and especially some of those Muslim fellows who came through our program who just were there, and they weren't there for any other reason other than they needed to be there for their friends. And that there was something really significant about that. But coming together is so much easier when we actually know each other and when we work together. And so as I think about Charlottesville and Pittsburgh and the awful that is unleashing around us, I turn back to these relationships and these friends that are willing to stand up and step forward together. And I want to couch it in that you already heard from David about about essentially white nationalism and what's at the core, the anti-Semitism, because it's something that extends far beyond, I mean, it definitely impacts Jews, and it extends beyond. So I'm going to read something from Eric Ward. He had a piece called Skin in the Game, How Anti-Semitism Animates White Nationalism. It's in Political Research Associates, and he's had it published in a number of other places. Quote, what is the arch nemesis of white race, whose have prevented the natural and inevitable imposition of white supremacy? It is, of course, the Jews. Jews function for today's white nationalists as they have often have for anti-Semites through the centuries, as the demon stirring an otherwise changing and heterogeneous pot of lesser evils. Continues to explain that within this ideological matrix, Jews, despite and indeed because of the fact that they are often read as white, are a different, unassimilable enemy race, then must be exposed, defeated, ultimately eliminated. Anti-Semitism, I discovered, is a particular and potent form of racism so central to white supremacy that black people would not win our freedom without tearing it down. That's a quote directly from him. Because anti-Semitism is something that impacts all of us. And hatred and bigotry are something that really affect all of us. And my last quote from him is that fighting anti-Semitism cuts off the fuel for the sake of all marginalized communities under siege. Now, the numbers of the FBI hate crimes report that David mentioned, what's significant especially is that so Jews actually have the highest number of hate crimes committed against them. Muslims are the fastest rising number of hate crimes. And it's of course broken down. I'm still only speaking Muslims and Jews right now because that's who I am. But recognizing that this is something that impacts more than one different community. And specifically that when we can work together, we can find other ways of doing things. Because the problem's actually going to get worse, not better. And what I'm basing this off is by 2055, we're going to be a minority-majority country. As those demographics shift, this stretch for power is actually going to continue to worsen. Now, the good news is that in California, we're actually have already shifted, where we have a minority, we still have a white majority in terms of a block, but minorities have now become the majority electorate. And so as we've been shifting, we've actually had some really important leadership, like that of Governor Brown, who has been appointing, making judicial appointments of minorities and women at record rates that are completely unprecedented. And it's that kind of leadership that can help us start to shift things, where we can, one, be there for each other, but be there for each other in positions of power. But more specifically, and why I'm doing the work that I do, and why I sit on the Muslim Jewish Advisory Council, which is actually convened by the American Jewish Committee and the Islamic Society of North America, is that there's a lot at stake and there's a lot that's on the line. And so if we're actually going to counteract this, doing it together is really critical. And so one of the things that we've done is to actually pass the Protect work with Congress and the Senate, and it's actually been signed by the President, believe it or not, Protecting Religiously Affiliated Institutions Act of 2018. And that basically expands federal protections to different institutions, religious institutions, because these numbers continue to climb and there's a lot of work that we need to be doing as a community, as one. And the temptation is going to be there, where we're going to be pushed and pulled and torn into all sorts of different directions. But when we come together, we can actually find another path where friends show up for friends, where we look at, where we feel it in our bones when our friends are impacted, when we see their pain, and when we decide there's something that we can do together about this really horrific problem.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for the invitation to be here. A few weeks ago, I was at the 50th anniversary gala of the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, MALDEF, and a series of previous leaders of that all-important organization repeated the same message when they came up to the podium, which is that they were very sad. As beautiful as the occasion was, they were very sad that the organization still has to exist to fight for the rights of Mexicans in the United States. And so it's a similar sense of sadness that we are here. Last spring, I got into a rental 4x4 with the Westwood-born photographer Richard Misrach. And I had ridden shotgun with Richard before, but a year earlier, he and I spent a week together driving up and down the 2,000-mile-long line of the U.S.-Mexico border, because Richard had spent about 10 years photographing the increasing militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border wall before Trump. But last year's trip, we were scouting for something else. During the Obama years, Richard had started noticing, while he was looking for traces of border militarization, he started noticing messages that had been spray painted on rocks and on roads and on hillsides, and started noticing that the messages he was seeing were increasingly turning darker. He found a hangman's noose in the sand by the Salton Sea. In Nevada, he spotted a crucified Jesus that someone had used for target practice. And right on the side of Highway 50, a large swastika made of stones. 3 days before the election of Donald Trump, he caught a sign in bright MAGA red that declared, quote, "Trump loves American people," a lone beacon on a hill of desert sagebrush. In the months after the inauguration, Richard kept driving, and he drove through Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and he invited me to come with him. And he wanted me to see now what he was seeing on these trips. The boulders and the empty buildings of the desert Southwest have become their own kind of public sphere, we decided. A sprawling land art comment section, brimming with evidence of a newly emboldened American anger, racism, and fatalism. We saw messages like, "Set fire to your local bank, leave now, and everything must end." But more than anything, messages about Jews and Nazis. In the Mojave Desert, in California, miles between towns and only a couple hours drive to the hipster paradise of the Coachella Music Festival. You can go right now and see how a swastika crowns a rock formation. In an abandoned home in Barstow, just 5 side street minutes from a bustling strip mall, there's another swastika, sprayed in black and perfectly framed by a kicked out window. Neither of these images are signed or claimed. Who put them there? We don't know. Who put them there, nuzzled next to peace signs and hearts inscribed with lovers' names? Richard has kept shooting. He has been on the road for pretty much the last year. And I asked him if I could share some of these images. This is we're going to be forthcoming in his next major monograph with Aperture. Please, if I would ask, I would just ask that no one takes photographs of these and shares them. This is a part of a project he's calling Writing on the Wall that will probably be out in some form next year, but he's very generous to allow me to share some of these with you. So I'll just show you some. These are taken throughout the desert southwest. It's a swastika shot through an abandoned shack window. I need some Hebrew speakers to help me with this.
To be a free people.
KKK swastikas. More swastikas. Many of these connected to skinhead organizations. This is right near Coachella. I wanted to show this one because next to swastikas, this is the most common thing we see. And at first, we chuckled about it. And then we started realizing, of course, this is not anything to chuckle about. This is the actual convergence of hate and violence and anti-Semitism and racism with toxic masculinity. And as, of course, all the examples we've already heard about tonight that we all know so well are all acts that were perpetrated by men. And often these acts of extreme horrific violence are perpetrated by men who have previously perpetrated violence against women. And so the presence of swastikas and phalluses and, interestingly, always semi-erect penises are important. I'm going to leave this one up at least as a counter to some of that. So why all of this? We've heard, I'm not going to belabor and repeat the reports, but I did want to mention one report, the FBI report we've already heard about that just came out. But I do want to mention another report, because while we should praise California, yes, I'm with you. But I do want to remind us that in 2017, in February of last year, the Southern Poverty Law Center, of which Eric Ward, I believe is still director, works high up.
He works for the Western Center,
found that in 2016, California was home to 79 hate organizations, more than half of them in Southern California, mm-hmm. scattered throughout the suburbs, deserts, and valleys between San Diego and Los Angeles. And so many of those images are taken actually from Southern California, just an hour and a half, 2 hour drive from here. So amongst the reports, the FBI reports that have been mentioned, I want to just second what we just heard about while on the one hand, the multiplicity of groups whose status as victims of hate crimes are rising. And I want to underline that 48.6% of the race-based hate crimes that the FBI found last year were motivated by anti-black, anti-African-American bias. 48.6%. But yes, anti-Semitism, of course, is, as we heard, and as David, I think, so eloquently showed us with the long historical arc, it's always there, ebbing and flowing in its surfacing. We might call anti-Semitism submarine. It is visibly invisible. It is forever latent. It's a fuse that is always ready to be lit. And lit again, it has been. So many of the things we've already heard about. I want to also mention the school photo of the boys at the Wisconsin school who asked in their school photo to pose, casually threw up a Nazi salute with one member in the front, also showing the white nationalist gesture and bragging that of all of the students, the one African-American student was also had his hand in the air, and one of the white young white men was proud that he, quote, got the black kid to do it. The Jews will not replace us slogan is incredibly important because it reminds us that what we're talking about here is the terror that some still feel of white supremacy's end. The constant baiting with George Soros that we've already mentioned, and I just want to add to that, though, this international Jew figure, reborn as a Holocaust survivor, with Trump mimicking Viktor Orban in Hungary, who has been one of the leading myth makers about Soros. But I also want to say that if people have been following what's been happening at the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana over the past few days, the increasing racism by Mexicans against Central Americans, against Central American migrants, one of the things that you are increasingly hearing are Mexicans in Tijuana saying, well, these people are just coming here because of that guy, George Soros. They don't know who George Soros is, but they're repeating what Trump is saying. And all of these things keep linking back. So let me just end by saying that while I showed you these images, I also want to make sure that you see that an image like this, while there is a call for Trump 2020, that's a swastika on the left that somebody has brushed out. And there is pushback. There are opportunities in Pittsburgh as a result of the attack. The arrival of Reverend Manning of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, who came to Pittsburgh to declare solidarity and also to remind us of the historical echoes of Jim Crow laws that were used by Hitler and the Nazis, remind us that anti-Jewish hatred has taken the form of anti-black racism in the past in Nazi propaganda about so-called Negroid Jews, of the importance of remembering that when violence visits us, it must also be an opportunity to join with others who have had violence visited upon them. Just as we remember that one of the reasons that Pittsburgh happened is that members of the synagogue were not just Jewish, they were known for their work aiding in non-Jewish refugees. In the eyes of white supremacy, the Jew may be the eternal enemy based on his immutable difference as a Jew, but also because of his relationship to a tradition of coalition and justice and aid that in a world of Trumps and Orbans and Bolsonaros and Proud Boys and skinheads and is more radical and dangerous than ever before. I'm going to end with one last quick point, which is the night after Pittsburgh, I was driving east to west down Pico Boulevard with my seven-year-old daughter to go see a ballet, and we were driving down Pico, and Pico was, for those of you who were around Pico Boulevard that night, empty. It was a ghostly experience, made ever more ghostly because the street was lined more than ever before with security guards and police stationed outside of various synagogues in the Pico Robertson area. And we kept driving until we got to my synagogue, which is Nate Nowell's. And I was very happy. I was taking my daughter there for the first time, and we were going to be with my people. And I sit down and I look around, and my people are around me. And then I start listening to my people, and I hear one of my people say, well, Trump at least tells the truth. He's not so bad. I mean, he's better than Obama. There's a lot of work still to do.
So I want to thank the speakers for their extraordinary comments and kind of start the conversation. My role as moderator is to, like, yeah, I'm going to take one little prerogative and just ask one question, but then it's actually to get some conversation going, because I think there have been really interesting ideas and connections that are that have already been raised. Here's my hard question. My hard question is a question about linked faiths, right? Why does any individual see a connection with the group, however defined, right? A racial group, a religious group, some sort of peoplehood. Oftentimes it is a sense of linked faith, that I'm a Korean American, I see my fate and my daughter's fate as being connected to, frankly, a Japanese American person here. Why? Because from a distance we all look alike. That has been the challenge that we've always had to confront. There are practical realities of linked faiths that come from people. One way to create unity across differences is to actually identify the similarities, why we might be linked. But then we see examples of both success and failure. So we saw, you know, Brenda talks about examples where, again, African Americans understood the plight of Jewish Americans. And again, think about what Jewish Americans did in the Civil Rights Movement on behalf of African Americans. That connection, the understanding, the human empathy of linked faiths was extraordinary. Nevertheless, it wouldn't take long for us to find examples where that doesn't work out so well. When we think about, again, Mexicans against Central Americans, right? Linked fate. I mean, from a distance, Americans don't care. They're all south of the border. Nevertheless, that doesn't create a unity. Think about Koreans and blacks in 1992 or Latinos. I mean, linked faith. Even think about the fate of, again, different phobias, whether they might be phobias of Jews, phobias of Muslim, the constant othering of a slightly darkened people that is viewed always as conspiring, forever foreign. Lots of similarities, but we know it doesn't always work out. So what I'm trying to figure out is, my impulse is try to find connection through linked faiths. Now, it's not just a crass self-interest turn. Oh, because I need your, you know, you need your back covered, so watch my back. I mean, something deeper than that. I see something profoundly human in the two of us, even though we're separated by some social identity. I just wanted to hear, like, without being overly Pollyannish about this, about whether this idea of linked fate does work to actually get us beyond the other petty tendencies that constantly exist. Because we've seen examples that work and examples that don't. And I just love to hear both the historical view and people's more recent experiences and why we should be optimistic or pessimistic about that challenge. So any of you, start us off. Oh, Brenda, let's hear your thoughts.
Well, I think, you know, just to use your term, Josh, is ebb and flow. You know, somebody used the term of ebb and flow. So I think what happens is that we are all linked. I mean, we are all humans, for once. And I think that that's one of the things that people who are othered realize about one another is that we are the, as part of this othering group, we have to continue to reassert our humanity. We have to continue to reassert the fact that, you know, that we have a spiritual being, that we have have intellect, that we have family, community, children, hopes, and dreams. And so often we'll see in the ways in which we are characterized by members of the alt-right and then by members who are not in the alt-right, people who are just living in our society, who are annoyed about something, because it can be that simple. You know, is this kind of big belief that these people, us, are not humans, that we don't need the same kind of care, we don't need the same kind of attention, we don't have the same kind of ambitions, we don't want our children to have the same kinds of lifestyles, and those kinds of things. So I think that, I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but it has worked. It has worked, you know, and there are many famous instances where it has worked. There are other instances where it has not worked, but at the best moments is when people realize that, you know, there is a level of human decency and acceptance that we have to push for. And equality, you know, an American ideal, and equality that we really have to work for everyone. And we cannot afford to turn our backs on people because they are better off than us, or because they speak a different language, or because they worship a different God, or in a different way. And so I think in the best moments that has happened, and we've seen that your organization, for example, is a new example of that, you know, pushing across time. And so this linkage, there's a linkage across humanity, you know, and I think that we all have a sense of decency about, you know, what humans, how humans should be treated. And when we allow ourselves to act on that, desire to be part of that, making sure that happens, then really positive things happen for everyone.
Sure.
You know, I grew up in Virginia. I grew up in the segregated South. I went to the University of Virginia. I know Charlottesville very well. I know, you know, the Confederate, I'm getting ready to go home for Christmas. The Confederate flag's all over my state, you know, in my hometown and everywhere else you want to drive in Virginia. But there are also people who I know collectively feel that that should not be, even though it still exists in certain, and I have to link with those people. I have to go, I have to be in my home. I have to think about those people, link with those people, work with those people, and I think that's super important. But I just want to add one last thing, which was that you're talking about Pico Boulevard, but the Sunday after the massacre in Pittsburgh, my husband and I were driving from our home in Baldwin Hills to Pasadena, and we, you know, those series of bridges that you have as you go to Pasadena, there was a huge pink sign that was hanging down from one of those bridges that said, "You will not replace us." So if you think that hate does not exist in Southern California, you have the 79 hate groups. People were out working, and they were telling anyone who passed under that sign, huge, huge, I think it was a pink sheet or something that had been spray painted. They were saying, "We're here, it's not just in Pittsburgh," okay? And letting everyone who felt like them know that we're here.
So more comments about the possibility of link fake, when it works, when it doesn't work. Thoughts? David?
Yeah, a few thoughts. There's an irony in that it's very often the case that tragedy is what reveals linked fates, that it is that moment of the bearing of emotions that reveals the shared historical experience or humanity. And I think the challenge is to think of ways in which you can effect a linked fate without having to make recourse to tragedy, because I think that is the very common experience. I think part of the difficulty is that, in a certain sense, the human experience moves between two poles, a pole of radical difference on one hand and a pole of identity on the other, in the sense of equivalence. And finding the sweet spot between those two is, and calibrating it again and again, is really difficult. So I think, you know, difference in the appropriate doses makes for the extraordinary beauty of the human fabric. Difference in a more radical way produces sort of unbridgeable chasms. So finding the sweet spot whereby the difference allows you to recognize the other as distinct from you but human is a really difficult task, and you have to. You have to somewhat consciously minimize that impulse to assert your own radical difference, not to the point of identity, but to the point of being able to get out of yourself to see the story of the other, the humanity of the other. And I think it's really challenging, especially in a period that accentuates the difference of different groups of people. which insists upon it as a matter almost of state policy, to really hit that sweet spot.
Yeah. I wonder if either because of practice or because of art and photography, different ways to actually activate the movement towards the right direction, where we can celebrate a difference, but it never veers into dehumanization.
I just have some jumbled thoughts, but like just to pick up on the sweet spot idea. I mean, most of my work is actually not photography, but is on music, with some dabbling in food. And you know, music and food are sweet spots for these kinds of conversations. Now they're, I've been accused, and I will accuse myself of using them romantically, but I believe in the power of romance for political aims. Where you know, every time we listen to a piece of music, every time we are listening to somebody else's body, breath, lungs, blood, cellular tissue entering our blood, cellular tissue, skin, flesh, brain. The songs that are like, that's my song. That's not your song. That comes from somebody else's life and their experiences. And yet we think of it without actually thinking about it as our own. And yet we are doing what Martin Buber famously said, all living is meeting. All living is meeting. Right? What shows us that more than culture, more than music? Every time we eat, literally eating something created by somebody who's not ourselves with their bare hands, and that goes into our body to literally keep us alive and nourish us. There's powerful building blocks for those sweet spots. Now, to critique my own romance, right? The links are everywhere. There's no shortage of links. That's who we are. We are linked. It's that we are taught, either we're taught not to see those links systematically, or, you know, we're talking about anti-Semitism, we're talking about racism. These are hell of a drug. So I was just in Berlin for the last semester, you know, and I'd never been to Germany before. And going around all these big mansions where all of these Jews lived, who were leaders of industry, who, doesn't matter how much they contributed to the economy, still had to go. I think about Trump closing the border in Tijuana. $1.4 million of economic traffic a day, but the wall needs to be closed. So even when I think like, oh, capitalism will prevail over hate, it doesn't. Last point I want to make, we haven't talked about yet, is my daughter, who I mentioned, who's 7, her school, like all schools in Los Angeles, are worried about diversity. And talk about diversity all the time, and tout how diverse the school is. And I remember going to the first day and looking at her class and looking at her school picture, thinking, there's no diversity in this classroom. But then realizing that what I was seeing actually was the fact that everyone in her class, including her, was just like a lighter shade of brown. They were all kids from mixed marriages, from mixed cultures, from mixed parents. And that is one of the fastest growing populations in the United States. It's not a metaphorical link, but an actual link. Mm-hmm. And that, the numbers we heard about 2045, 2055, whatever it is, that minority majority transformation is also going to be lived with a whole new generation of millions of people who don't have the luxury, in most cases, of choosing one side over the other, because that'd be suicide. It'd be killing oneself. And I think that's a moment I'm excited to see what that produces.
Aziza, I'm going to make sure that you get a chance, and then we'll open up the conversation.
Yeah, I want to say, like, I think that the differences are really actually very important, and that they are a window by which we can understand each other better. And